I just wanted to give a few words of thanks. First, to the Warden and Fellow of All Souls for their hospitality. Second, to Craig Clunas and his colleagues in History of Art, who've been extremely welcoming and supportive. Also to Christopher Brown and his colleagues at the Ashmolean Museum, who've also been very welcoming. I must thank my wife, who has prevented me from saying so far anything too asinine in these lectures. She is a considerable scholar in this field herself. And I would also, finally, like to thank my audience, who have been extremely loyal. Thank you very much. I don't know what I'm going to do next Wednesday. Pine, probably. I'm fed up that I've changed the title of this last lecture. It was going to be called Naturalism Strikes Back, in honour of George Lucas and Star Wars, but I've chickened out for a more Oxford title. In my final lecture, I want to consider a current in French painting, which I believe has rarely been fully acknowledged, let alone closely analysed. This is the increasing lack of momentum in avant-garde French painting in the 1890s, particularly in the final two-thirds of the decade. There is a tendency in our history of modern painting to assume that the innovations of the late 1880s and early 1890s continued to have a forward momentum until the early years of the 20th century, when they were washed aside by the new innovative forces of first Fauvism and then Cubism. After all, such an assumption might go, Gauguin continued to work until 1903 and Cézanne until 1906. Signac was one of the neo-impressionist avant-garde who exhibited at the last impressionist exhibition in 1886 and who in 1904 hosted Matisse on the brink of Fauvism at his home in Saint-Tropez. These are continuities which suggest a consistency of painterly impact and innovation, and they underlie, implicitly at least, the somewhat numbing concept of post-impressionism. This modernist notion uses a term only coined in 1910, one quite alien to the artists it so glibly covers. But my chief objection to the term post-impressionism is that it pays little attention to the pictorial evidence of advanced painting during the 1890s and fails to situate that evidence within the larger social and cultural patterns of the decade. As I try to address these deficiencies in this lecture, I will make a different case. My argument is that from about 1893 to 4, the progressive dynamic of avant-garde painting, which in these lectures I have considered in terms of style, began to wane. I'll give evidence to support that case, but I want in particular to concentrate on two other related points. The first is the apparent paradox of the avant-garde's sporadic but significant engagement with tradition. How was it that some of the most inventive artists of this period, Van Gogh, Signac or Redon, deliberately engaged their work with the art of the past? The second is to suggest that by the end of the decade, a number of leading avant-garde artists had reverted to forms of naturalism. This latter argument returns, of course, to the main theme of these lectures, that naturalism was the dominant aesthetic of French visual culture in the last two decades of the 19th century. Just as I have argued that one of the reasons for this were naturalism's elisions with republicanism, so I will propose today that the return to naturalism, which one can trace in the work of several important painters, had some consistencies with wider politico-cultural processes. By the end of the 90s, it was evident to informed art critics that momentum had been lost in avant-garde painting. Reviewing the 1897 Salon des Indépendants for La Plume, the disappointed Ivanhoé Rambosson regretted that we're a long way from that rich period 6 or 8 years ago, which had seen the emergence of artists such as Denis, Bonnard and Cotté. Writing in 1899, Julien Leclerc agreed that 1886 to 92 had been the years in which innovative painting had thrived at the Indépendant. He voiced this opinion in a review of an exhibition at the Douro-Ruel Gallery, which combined neo-impressionists such as Signac and Loos, there at the top, it's all right, we've managed it, and nabby painters like Vuillard and Denis, there at the bottom. Leclerc saw this alliance as a means of showing a degree of unity amongst avant-garde artists, and that instinct for cohesion, which he noticed, is an issue to which I shall return. But after the flowering of the nabby between 1890 and 1903 or so, no major innovative pictorial style emerged in the 1890s to coalesce and drive young painters. Both the imaginative colour and decorative patterning of the nabby and the slightly longer established divisionist chromatics and harmonious arabesques of neo-impressionism evolved and consolidated during the 90s. But there was an awareness of diminished momentum. As the decade passed, there was an increasing appreciation that Cézanne was a painter of real stature. But his work appeared truculently individual. Cézanne himself did little to promote it, and there was no collective effort to make something of the stylistic potential of his painting. Much the same was true of Van Hoff's work. If avant-garde painting was no longer seen to be flourishing at the Indépendant, the whole notion of the avant-garde might be sensed to be shifting, both personnel and even institution. Visiting the conservative Salon des Artistes Français in 1897, Signac was horrified to find that Henri Martin, then producing decorations like the apotheosis of Clémence Isaure for major buildings such as the city halls of Paris and Toulouse, was using a technique that Signac thought pillaged from neo-impressionism. In Signac's eyes, the offence here was not merely appropriating neo-impressionist style by an école-trained artist, but also it's being put to the service of the state in major civic buildings. By the end of the 1890s, the sombre-toned painting emerging at the middle of the road Salon de la Nationale, the work of naturalists such as Cotte and Simon, as well as more elusive artists like René Ménard and Henri Le Sidanais, could be taken by contemporaries to define the new painters of the avant-garde. Today, we might consider Ménard and Le Sidanais as symbolist artists, but little links them in terms of style. The one, rhetorical and muscular in his elegies to antiquity, the other, understated and diffuse in his Flemish townscapes. But then symbolist painting had never coalesced round any individual style. Rather, it had encompassed a range of possibilities. Among these were, for example, Alphonse Auzbert's muted, static, classicising compositions indebted to Puvis de Chavannes, and the self-consciously graceful and retardataire pictures of Armand Point. Such deliberately undescriptive and mannered work, repudiating naturalism for idealism, provoked a backlash from writers and artists who valued the carnal and healthy. Zola attacking such images of sexless virgins who have neither breasts nor buttocks. The intellectual and cultural mentalité which admired and expected naturalism, with its steady grasp on the material world ratified by science and technology, remained deeply entrenched. In 1895, Claude Monet exhibited 20 of his series of Rouen Cathedral at the Douro Royal Gallery. These were paintings in which Monet strayed, perhaps as far as he ever did, from the objectively descriptive. This is evident both from his practice. The canvases were painted gradually over many months, mainly in his studio away from the motif, and from the way the Rouen cathedrals look, with their densely layered encrustations of pigment, so contrary to ordinary visual experience. Yet a number of the critics who reviewed the show, both supporters and detractors, slipped into scientific language, mentioning the chromatic theories of Eugène Chevreul and Ogden Rood, or judging the pictures as schemas of optical theorems, to use Raymond Bouillet's expression. Such responses to works of art, the demand for vigour and carnality, the instinct for scientific parallels, testify to the cultural hegemony of the actual in the modern mentalité that I have termed naturalism. I want now to trace the avant-garde's engagement with tradition. We're on tricky territory here. Tradition is a slippery term. One artist's understanding of tradition, how it might be valued and used, would not be the same as another artist's. But this elastic word was common parlance in the 1890s, and I want to explore how it manifested itself within the avant-garde. From the start, I must acknowledge that avant-garde painters' engagements with the art of the past were various, sporadic, and inconsistent. But if we piece together some of the evidence, the apparently paradoxical conjunction of avant-garde and tradition raises some fascinating issues. One reading of naturalist painting was that it was based on direct observation, attention to the motif or the document, and by implication, it had no need of tradition. It simply recorded. This was Mirbeau's take on Monet's direct painting from nature, when he wrote in 1889 that, with Monsieur Claude Monet, we are far from tradition. Another approach was for supportive critics or artists themselves to trace the genealogy of naturalist painting back through the work of Édouard Manet, Gustave Courbet and Théodore Géricault. But naturalist artists did look attentively at the art of the past. I discussed in a previous lecture Rolls and Baynard's visits to Belgium to study Rubens. Both Bastien Lepage on the left and Friant on the right visited the Netherlands and were particularly impressed by the precision of Holbein's portraits, the echo of which can be seen in their work. On occasion, the even more recent naturalist heritage was quite directly cited. At the 1893 Artiste Français, Daniel Bouveret exhibited In the Meadow on the left, a simple motif of a peasant woman and a cow in a sparse, extensive landscape. Subject and composition recall Jean-François Millet's 1858 Woman Pasturing a Cow, which Daniel would have seen at Millet's École des Beaux-Arts retrospective in 1887. Millet's Gleaners had also been shown in 1887, and again at the Exposition Universelle in 1889. The following year, Le Sénéchal de Cadreret exhibited at the Salon des Artistes Français his Oyster Gatherers at Cancale, a composition which echoes the Gleaners. By making such implicit pictorial references, a naturalist painter identified his work with tradition. In this case, the work of Millet made only three decades ago and recently validated by the official retrospective of 1887. So a modern naturalist tradition, blessed by the Republic. Elsewhere, an engagement with tradition could involve a consultation of past art with motifs which were distinctly non-naturalist and involved the search for style. In 1898, Léonce Bénédict could identify a return to the masters. He found it in very diverse areas of contemporary French painting. He traced it in Anquetil's work, with its deliberately Rubensian character, and also in the work of Gustave Moreau's pupils, artists like Georges Rouault, whose work combined the brooding chromatics of Rembrandt with the graphic gaucherie of Quattrocento art. Bénédict classified these distinct and independent initiatives as a poetic reaction against the naturalist movement. If naturalism remained the dominant aesthetic, against which some artists needed to define themselves, the art of the past offered a spectrum of solutions, as much to avant-garde painters as to students emerging from Moreau's atelier at the École des Beaux-Arts. After all, even the most audacious art needs its own justifications, filiations, and continuities. That could be seen on the yellow walls of Gauguin's Paris studio in January 1895. In this private showing, aimed at an elite audience, Gauguin showed his recent work from Brittany, along with Japanese prints, and photographs of work by old masters such as Cranach, Holbein and Botticelli, and his favoured modern painters, Degas, Manet and Puvis de Chavannes. Gauguin also displayed work by contemporaries he admired, Redon, Cézanne and Van Gogh. With typical temerity, Gauguin revealed what the critic Julien Leclerc called his monde, his musée imaginaire. We might ask what it was that made an avant-garde painter in the 1890s need such a world. Did the return to the masters symptomise a deficiency in the avant-garde? In Gauguin's case, was his fraternity with artists he knew, Degas, Redon, or had even worked, Van Gogh, an insufficient bond to justify and contextualise his own work? But there is a counter-question. Might one not argue that the avant-garde's periodic allusions to past art were to a certain extent an expression of confidence? By suggesting or even drawing attention to the links between one's own work and one's chosen antecedents, one could assert the continuities and the vitality of style, justifying innovative style with reference to the past. And in so doing, one could define one's distance from naturalism. Van Gogh made regular references to past art in his correspondence. But his most intense engagement with tradition came with the 28 copies he made at Saint-Rémy between September 1889 and early 1890. Why should an artist in his mid-30s, with a decade's experience and hundreds of paintings and drawings under his belt, return to what was usually a tyro's practice? In his letters, Van Gogh gave a range of reasons in typically scattershot manner. Aware of his isolation in the Provençal asylum, he explained in a letter of mid-September that copying was a kind of study that I need, for I want to learn. This was not an expression of fading confidence, but a useful exercise in the bad weather of autumn. The letter pragmatically stated that copying means that I must not lose sight of the figure, even though I have no models at the moment. The examples he chose, Millet above all, with 20 copies, but also Delacroix and Rembrandt, were artists confident in a kind of drawing of the human figure, with torsion and contrapposto, which Van Gogh had never mastered. Copying them was a practical lesson. In his isolation, copying another painter's composition gave him a surrogate partner, a fellow artist with whom to collaborate. Copying also had an emotional dimension. The same September letter explained that copying gives me consolation. For in his isolation, Van Gogh imagined Millet surrounded by a big family and wanted his pregnant sister-in-law, Jo, to see his copy of Millet's La Veillée there on the right, an evening scene of a family interior. In a bittersweet way, copying reminded him of what he lacked and diverted him from it. In addition, to use the composition of a Millet or another artist via the medium of a reproductive print as the basis for a painting made with Van Gogh's own choice of colour, mark and surface was like, to use his own metaphors, an instrumentalist's interpretation of a composer's piece of music or the translation of a text into another language. But although this transformative process was personal, Van Gogh also came to see it as having an educational purpose. In September 1889, he suggested that reproductions after Millet in schools would benefit children. But by the following January, he went further, envisaging his own copies as an attempt to make Millet's work more accessible to the great general public. Van Gogh's copies thus had complex motives. Among these were issues of style, the imposition of the creative moi onto an existing design. But Vincent also made more elusive references to other art. In the summer of 1890, he spent the last 2 months of his life at Auvers-sur-Oise. Charles d'Aubigny, one of the pioneering naturalist landscape painters of mid-century, had lived at Auvers from 1860 until his death in 1878. Vincent painted d'Aubigny's house on two occasions, and his homage to his predecessor is also evident in the double square landscapes he painted of the fields at harvest, which both in their format and breadth of touch refer to d'Aubigny's own canvases of the local terrain, and that's d'Aubigny on the top and Van Gogh at the bottom. Odillon Redon presents a very different case. Highly individual as his lithographs may appear at first sight, They quite frequently refer to past images of the kind that the enlightened amateur, privately perusing an album, might be expected to recognise. Take the first state of the frontispiece to Hodor's album A Gustave Flaubert of 1889. The winged devil there on the left, flying from right to left, head twisted and knee crooked, calls to mind the lithograph of Mephistopheles flying over the town from Delacroix's 1828 Faust album. Or a head entitled My Kisses Have the Taste of a Fruit from Rodin's third album inspired by Flaubert's Tentation de Saint-Antoine. This 1896 lithograph, with its ornate helmet and passive features, is another quotation, this time of the idealised heads of Michelangelo's presentation drawings. Such references laid a very careful trail by a very tactical artist. By recognising such allusions, the spectator affirmed his own cultivated status amongst Rodin's elite audience and sensed his empathy with the artist. For his part, Rodin acknowledged his inheritance from the great imaginative art of the past, claiming for himself a pedigree that only the elite could recognise. In other words, tradition and style elided to validate an exclusive art for an exclusive public. Signac provides a third example of an avant-garde artist's positive dialogue with past art. The first decade of Signac's neo-impressionism, from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, looks like a confident development of style, with a progress towards individuality of touch, audacity of colour, and harmoniously arabesqued compositions. But by the mid-1890s, the value of past art began to infuse the self-taught artist. In 1894, working on the major painting In Time of Harmony, Signac wrote in his journal, "I'm seized by the desire to go to Italy, to revisit Florence and Rome. How much good it would do me to see Michelangelo's decorative figures again before finishing my painting." This enthusiasm for past art only grew in the second half of the decade, after the lukewarm reception of In the Time of Harmony, and with the increasing consensus voiced by the critics with whom I began this lecture, that neo-impressionism and other avant-garde painting had lost momentum. For the combative Signac, tradition, a term he used, had double value. The first was oppositional. Revisiting the Salon des Artistes Français in 1897, he recoiled. "No, no, they are not in the tradition, the sad image makers or photographers of the Salon." Tradition, then, was anti-naturalist. The second was practical. Tradition could be used for problem solving. Primarily a landscape painter, Signac was troubled by the extent to which his picture-making practice should, or needn't, respond to nature. In spring 1898, he made a 3-week pilgrimage to Turner, intently studying the collections in the National Gallery and the British Museum. A year later, he set himself to draw from Turner's The Rivers of France, making notes full of technical observations. Turner clusters lights or darks on the same curve. He duplicates objects for extra impact. He puts 3 points of interest on a single axis. Signac's painting Bellevue of 1899 derives its composition from Turner's watercolour of Saint-Cloud, made about 1832. Upon Turner's armature, Signac amplified his own stylizations, unifying the picture surface under his decorative dotted touch, adding symmetrical repoussoir trees, and introducing warm tints from the muted pinks of blossoms and clouds to the sharp orange tiles which strike against the chill blue of the river. Immediately on returning from London in April 1898, Signac had written that Turner's works prove to me that one must be free of any idea of imitation or copy, and that one must create tints. How restricting it is that one should copy, how unlimiting it is that one can create. One of the first canvases that Signac painted after this was Capo di Noli. Based on recollections of a walking holiday on the Italian Riviera 18 months before, it was made from memory, not even a preliminary drawing. Signac wrote in his journal that, "I'd like to achieve an extreme polychromy." And to further this medley of rich chromatics, he juxtaposed samples of intensely coloured silks, then transferring his chosen conjunctions onto the canvas. Capo di Noli is indeed an extreme painting, modern in its fierce colouring and restless touch, traditional in its balanced Clodian composition, and utterly insistent on style in their composition. What conclusions can we draw from this evidence about tradition? Looking back to the past had practical uses. Copying Delacroix or Millet made Van Hoogh invent colour for their compositions. Studying Turner encouraged Signac to create tints. Whether in technical matters, like encouraging chromatic innovation, or in more general terms, reinforcing ideas about continuities of style, an engagement with past art widened the divide between avant-garde stylization and the naturalism it so determinedly opposed. That said, one cannot escape the sense that generating a deliberate dialogue between past and contemporary art was symptomatic of a diminishing momentum within the avant-garde. The drive to detach new painting from naturalism, which had so marked the years between about 1885 and 92, had diminished. Turning back to past art may have been an attempt to resuscitate that energy, but it might also be seen as a concern to validate what had been gained. For the later 1890s, I want to argue, was a period in which the avant-garde found it necessary to consolidate in response to wider pressures. The second argument of this lecture is the one which will lead me to close the series. For I believe that we can trace a distinct return to naturalism in the later 1890s, a series of shifts by several avant-garde painters who actually retreated from style to more descriptive work. Before we start analysing such renunciations or consolidations, let me just show you some examples of what I mean, for this is a current that you will not find identified in the literature. Among the older Impressionists, Camille Pissarro had begun the 1890s painting his way out of the stylistic constraints of Neo-Impressionism and returning to a more spontaneous touch. But at the beginning of the decade, there remained a pantheistic rhetoric to some of his landscapes, and he even essayed some evocative figure subjects. By the second half of the decade, however, both in his landscapes and the cityscapes of Paris boulevards and Rouen quays, Pissarro had returned his impressionism to the doggedly descriptive, strict adherence to local colour, weather in all her moods, scenes of quotidian banality. If Monet's Rouen cathedrals, shown in 1895, represent an apogee of painterly style over description, in the succeeding years his work eased back to the sureties of observation. The Japanese bridges, shown in 1899, may be stylized in their symmetry and harmonies of green, but they represent a return to a more conventional understanding of colour, texture and fall of light. Several of the younger, quite unconnected Nabi painters followed similar paths. Take Edouard Vuillard's work. Pictures of early in the decade, like Mother and Daughter at the Table of 1891-2, made the domestic subject conform to the experimental demands of consistent flat touch, variegated patterning, and willed chromatics. By the decade's end, works such as Woman's Sweeping of 1899 had restored closer observation of detail, along with truth to texture and local colour. Much the same is true of Pierre Bonnard. What might have motivated these shifts back to naturalism on the part of these various painters? First, we often fail to recognise how very difficult it was for painters, trained on the life model to observe and copy nature, expected by that mentalité of scientific realism I outlined in my first lecture, to abandon naturalist practice. The most celebrated story of the avant-garde at this period is the incident at Pont-Aven in Brittany in September 1888, when Gauguin gave Paul Sérusier the painting lesson that resulted in the little talisman, so called because of its importance for Sérusier's Parisian friends, such as Denis, Bonnard and Vuillard. "If you see green trees," Gauguin instructed Sérusier, "just paint them so, with green straight from the tube." This encounter is taken to typify the rejection of exact representation of observed nature for a synthetic simplification of form, the liberation of colour and imagination. There's nothing wrong with that account, but look at it in perspective. During 1888, Sérusier had been painting naturalist canvases such as Interior at Pont-Aven, a document, an image of community. Making the talisman did not mean instant conversion. A year later, in midsummer 1889, Sérusier was anxiously writing to Maurice Denis. "What is the role of nature in a picture? Must one work after nature, or only to look and memorise? Too great a liberty frightens me, poor copyist that I am." If abandoning naturalism was intellectually, even psychologically taxing, so it was practically. We find this in the work of fellow navvies Edouard Vuillard and Pierre Bonnard. Bonnard's Checkered Blouse, there on the right, a painting of 1892, is often discussed as an example of how he adapted from Japanese prints, flat patterning animated by undulating contours to suggest the body beneath, as part of his identifiable navvy style. But we neglect the preparatory watercolour, which shows that the original idea was more cluttered and descriptive, with the intruding figure seen from behind a naturalist cliché. Vuillard, like Sérusier, was articulate about how difficult he found abandoning the descriptive naturalism in which he had been so scrupulously schooled in the late 80s, for the navvy emphasis on synthetic form, surface touch, and non-objective colour. About September 1890, he wrote in his journal about Chardin's still lives, which is a student he had so closely emulated. That's of Vuillard's still life on the right. "Difficulty of establishing my head after long hours passed 2 years ago in front of these canvases imbued with naturalist ideas, not realising that there's no rapport between those ideas of copying them and the pleasure of harmonies of tone, pure and simple." Striving for style around 1890, Sérusier, Bonnard and Vuillard found it a wrench to abandon naturalism. That made it easier to return. Another motive for the return to naturalism was commercial. Pissarro, in his later 60s, was conscious of the need to produce canvases as saleable capital to provide for his wife and children after his death. Descriptive rather than experimental impressionist canvases provided that banker. With the navvy Félix Valitor, the evidence is also clear. In May 1899, he married and had a wife and stepchildren to support. In March that year, he had exhibited at Duhon-Ruel's 6 sharply delineated, torridly coloured intimacies, one of them on the left, style perfectly serving the subject of dangerous liaisons. Only one seems to have sold immediately, while a couple more were passed off at auction in 1900. 2 others were sold in 1908 and 09 respectively, and the 6th, Valitor, never sold. However, the softer, more conventional interiors on the right, which he began in 1889, sold well, 5 within months of completion, and in 1903, Woman Arranging Her Hair There was purchased by the state on the recommendation of Roger Marx. The market, attuned to the naturalist mentalité, preferred more descriptive art, it seems, and playing to commercial expectations paid off. But with both Vuillard and Valitor, whose work in the late 1880s had been determinedly naturalistic, and whose transition into the stylizations of Nabi painting had required a real effort of adaptation, the gradual relinquishing of style for work that was more immediately legible in the later 1890s was at once a return to their artistic instincts and formation, and perhaps a recognition that the pursuit of style ran the risk of being too hermetic and elitist. That in turn suggests that style, as the lever by which to prize art free from naturalism, was not always a sustainable solution, and that the avant-garde project itself was friable. To probe the return to naturalism further, it's essential, I think, to look beyond the avant-garde, indeed beyond the history of art, and return for a moment to the wider dimensions of France during the 1890s. There is a tendency to think of the decade's politics in terms of extremes. The first years might seem to be dominated by anarchist terrorism, by the campaign of propaganda by deed, which saw bombs thrown in central Paris, even in the Chamber of Deputies, finally culminating in the assassination of President Carnot in 1894, the image there on the left. The second half appears increasingly preoccupied with the deeply divisive Dreyfus affair, beginning with Dreyfus's condemnation in 1894 on the right, and culminating in the dramas of 1899, Déroulède's attempted coup in February and Dreyfus's pardon in September. But these are the headlines of history. One can argue that the 1890s was less a period of division than one of coalescence at the centre. After all, the Republic was toppled neither by anarchist terrorism nor by schisms over Dreyfus. The ralliement, launched in 1891, moderated the tensions between Republic and Church, which had been so acute in the 1880s. Where middle-class Catholics and Republicans found common ground was in their anxiety about the rise of socialism. Jules Guesde's Parti Ouvrier Français, for example, made a negligible impact in the 1889 election, but it won 160,000 votes in 1893 and doubled that in 1898. But if anything, the gradual advance of socialism encouraged consolidation around the centre, where rising politicians like Louis Barthou formed a strong, supple centrist bloc, allowing moderate social reform to stave off leftist demands. In literature, too, a new centrism emerged. In the late 1880s and early 1890s, the young symbolist elite had attacked the literary hegemony of naturalism, arguing that naturalism was too concentrated on the document, often too gross, and vaunting poetry as a more subtle medium than the novel. This struggle reached a public climax in 1891 with the journalist Jules Huret's publication of a series of interviews with writers of different factions discussing whether naturalism was finished, replaced by symbolism. But naturalism continued its hegemony. Zola's books dominated library loans of novels throughout the 1890s. Symbolism remained the elite taste it had always been, regularly attacked for being hermetic and witnessing important defections from its ranks. The later 1890s saw the emergence of a new consensual literary current, naturalism, an attempt to fuse the best of naturalism and symbolism. In 1896, Maurice Leblanc published Essai sur le naturalisme. This was followed in 1897 by the Revue Naturiste, with a manifesto by Leblanc's friend, the poet Saint-Georges de Bouillier, who also published his first volume of verse. The poetry we must put aside, but Leblanc's essay is significant because its consensual tone and engagement with the visual arts was important. Leblanc attacked symbolism for being precious and elitist while admiring Zola-esque naturalism as strong and healthy. He praised Bouillier's search for a national art based on the pantheistic fusion of nature and mysticism. Leblanc involved painters in his manifesto. He admired the natural brio of Monet and Cézanne, damned the bloodless dream imagery of Denis and Auber, and found naturism's ideal pantheist painter encompassing the sun and colours, but also God and ideas in Vincent van Gogh. As solidarism was in politics, so was naturism in literature, a shift to the consensual centre. Both aimed to synthesise the best from contemporary thought and culture. Both emerged from the nexus of republicanism and naturalism on which I have hinged these lectures. For both laid emphasis on egalitarianism and the national, seeking to reach out with policies which were inclusive and literature which was legible. And a parallel engagement with modern scientific ideas can be found in solidarism's organicism and naturism's sense of evolutionary metamorphosis. Crucially, both these concepts entered contemporary cultural parlance, and they coalesced around kinds of painting which about 1900 typified the continuing development of naturalism. For example, Alfred Rolle's work, since the early 80s closely engaged with social themes and republican ideology, was taken to encompass both terms. If for Léos Bénédict, canvases like The Miners' Strike articulated human solidarity, Raymond Bouillet could write of the naturism of other pictures as a hymn to life, like in The Joy of Life there on the right. In 1901, the painter Azard Damarest wrote a text featuring a fictional naturist who admires the work of naturalist artists as varied as Lhermitte and Cotté. This naturist finds Henri Martin's work a bit symbolising, a judgment true of the kind of painting that had so irritated Signac in 1897, pictures such as Clémence Isaure and Serenity. But by 1903, when Martin exhibited the first large canvas he had painted for a room of his work in the Capitole, the city hall of his native Toulouse, his work had changed. Martin's decoration, Summer, is the biggest of four canvases representing the seasons, with young lovers in the spring composition and an old woman in autumn. The cycle of the seasons also incorporates the human cycle. Summer represents the apogee of both. In the midsummer sunshine, vigorous men scythe hay while their female offspring play in the foreground. It is an image of health and plenty, of natural and human fecundity and continuity. With its embracing pantheism, Summer might be read as naturist. But look at the way Martin's scythers work to the same rhythm, in repeated poses. The work is shared, the men collaborate. Discreetly but legibly suggested are republican notions of égalité and fraternité, indeed, given modern parlance and the picture's natural environment, of solidarité. And we should go further still, for Summer is executed in a loosely divisionist touch, its coloured marks giving surface dynamism and optical vibration. This was what had annoyed Signac, not just what he alleged was the plagiarism of the neo-impressionist style, but its being put to the service of the state. For Signac, this was the offensive subordination of an avant-garde style, which he associated with the individualist ideology of anarchism, to the collective demands of republican ideology. But an alternative account would have been different. Summer was a painting, one could argue, that simultaneously conveyed civic values and an artist's own personal style. Summer exemplified the consensual character of republicanism's broad collective, as well as the enduring value of naturalism as a flexible idiom with which to broadcast it. The great Exposition Universelle of 1900, staged in Paris to celebrate the turn of the century, is an appropriate place to bring this series to an end. The main entrance to the Exposition was via a monumental gate designed by the architect René Binet. This extraordinary structure comprised a tripod of vast arches, surmounted by a sculpture of a fashionably dressed woman representing the city of Paris, and flanked by two minarets. Binet's fluid central arches in polychrome stone derived from his fascination with the work of the German zoologist Ernst Haeckel, from whose study of microscopic marine forms the architect derived his enfolding shapes. I'm going to talk about these elements at the side here. Binet's facing arch embraced the incoming visitor with walls reaching out to right and left. Along these walls ran the frieze of labour by the sculptor Anatole Guillot. In high relief figures slightly larger than life, Guillot represented the workers of the many trades which had made the exposition possible. These carpenters, masons, painters and blacksmiths were depicted descriptively in the clothing and with the tools of their métier. This ensemble was extremely eclectic in style and by no means pleased all visitors, but it somehow characterised France in 1900. On the surface, confident and grandiose, pitching itself as chic and modern, but also concerned to give its values concrete and legible form. Reading Binet's arches in terms of organicism and scientific modernity may have occurred to few, but below, Guillot's frieze of labour was self-evident. Writing in Art et Décoration, Paul Vitry immediately recognised its overt Republican credentials, legible just above head height as the crowds entered. He read Guillot's workers as healthy and energetic, manifesting the solidarity and the egalitarianism of labour. One understood them as voters, Vitry averred, in a work of elevated democratic and educational purpose. The entrance to the exposition may have been eclectic, but it was a naturalist work of art, egalitarian in its rhetoric and legible in its forms, that the Republic chose to introduce the visitor's experience of the Exposition Universelle. Reviewing the French paintings on show at the Exposition, the experienced critic Arsène Alexandre noted how the Centennale, a survey of French painting throughout the 19th century, was linked to the Décennale, a review of work of the last 10 years, by a carefully selected gallery. These canvases spanned from the 1860s to the 1890s. They included Manet's Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, so controversial in 1863, brought Impressionism into the fold with Renoir's 1874 Dancer and Monet's Pines at Antibes of 1888, acknowledged the new organicism of Carrière's sculptor Desvillers, and of course featured a range of naturalist canvases, from a historical scene by Jean-Paul Lahorse, Fontaine-Latour's 1878 Dubourg family, and Raffaelli's At the Founders. Alexandre told his readers of the centrist Republican Figaro that such eclecticism was apt because just, making a moral virtue out of the expedient instinct of the Republic's artistic policy. Raymond Bouillet, a critic inclined to the poetic and the traditional, admired the Décennale exhibition for showing how recent painting had developed from what he called the impersonal, in fact the literal, textual, mechanical naturalism of the 1889 Exposition Universelle, to accommodate the subtle Pas-de-Calais landscapes of Jean-Charles Cazin, Rolle's exuberant flesh painting, and Daniel Bouveret's imposing Last Supper. But for all this vaunting of diversity, this welcoming of more individual styles, such as Monet's or Carrière's, this admiration for the lyrical over the literal, naturalism was still the mainstream of French art. By naturalism, I mean, as I have throughout these lectures, more than the use of nature as the foundation of visual representation, so central to Western European culture. I mean that mentalité, that belief system, whereby the formation and progress of society was comprehended, gauged, promoted and learned through an intellectual and representational system which tightly linked image and ideology. Naturalist art, in particular naturalist painting, could serve the Republic so well because, as I've tried to show, it was flexible, supple enough to encompass varied talents, adaptable enough to depict any subject, not just with necessary pedagogical virtues like exactitude and legibility, but also with more creative characteristics such as ingenuity, impact, and memorability. A dozen years into the new century, in 1912, the Ministry of Public Instruction and Fine Arts published an educational package for use in schools, comprising slides of paintings of modern life accompanied by commentaries on each image. Many of the paintings and the ideological values they promoted will be familiar to you. The citizen's duty to celebrate and defend the Republic in Rolls' 14th of July. The virtues of skilled fraternal labour and the trauma of social division in Raffaelli's At the Founders or Rolls' Miners' Strike, which we've just seen. Urban existence and modern technology in Daniel's Wedding at the Photographers, alongside rural life and time-honoured skills in Martin's Summer. Newer styles but consistent values of youthful and familiar sociability in Renoir's Moulin de la Galette and Carrière's Brother's Kiss. Two of the paintings included amongst these officially accredited images were the two with which I began these lectures, Friant's All Saints' Day and Cotte's The Farewells. This is not surprising. They were in the state collections, had respectively won gold medals at the 1889 and 1900 Exposition Universelle. But such paintings had to function like flagships to the great fleet of images produced at this time. Canvases to be purchased for museums, bought for private collectors, illustrated in the mass circulation press, and such paintings had to lead the line. Works like Friant's All Saints' Day and Cotte's The Farewells became more than paintings. They were resonant with fundamental values around which the Republic sought to organise society. To begin with, the paintings accommodate difference of style, of course, but in their subjects, differences of class, bourgeois and labouring, and of setting, specific in Nancy, generic in Brittany. Overriding these differences are the consistencies, above all that of duty as social cement, duty to care and to work, to family and memory, to the collective and to continuity. You probably feel that I've been hammering away at these values, at the civic worthiness of these images, as if I had been some pompous Republican Minister for Public Instruction. Forgive me, but that's been the point. If paintings from the 1880s were still being used in schools in 1912 for the grooming of future citizens, it proves how functional, dominant, and heavy-handed was that naturalist Republican alliance. It suggests how closely most art with public recognition remained tied to the mainstream mentalité. That, in turn, questions the extent to which the avant-garde's evasion of the dominant naturalism via a search for style in the 1880s and 90s had actually succeeded in having much impact on the mainstream, and makes more understandable the return to the more naturalistic idioms by artists like Bonnard and Vuillard by 1900. In essence, I've been arguing that while it is a great pleasure to admire the outstanding pictorial achievements of Degas or Monet, Seurat or Gauguin, we do well not to overestimate the forward march of modernism. Such artists had to work within and against and around the dominant, insistent, deeply entrenched naturalism. By 1900, it even looked as if the individuality of less descriptive, more modernist art was buckling under naturalism's hegemony. Monet's and Renoir's work was being absorbed into the mainstream of the Exposition Universelle. Monet's recent painting, like Pissarro's or Valatore's or Bonnard's or Vuillard's, was edging back from style to description. Signac was railing against the absorption of neo-impressionist style into Republic civic commissions. There was a way out, but it was drastic. Look at Matisse's Still Life with Blue Tablecloth, painted about 1900. It makes no attempt to approximate to the consistency of vision, making a focus of a jug, but reducing the table to a patchwork of chromatic marks rather than a regular surface, completely denying any substance to the background, where what might be the illusion of physical space defined by walls becomes a medley of marks on the picture plane. This is a wonderful painting of energy and audacity, the canvas pulsing with juxtaposed oranges and blues, reds and greens, a picture in which much has gone into the risk of painting and precious little into description. Take Vlaminck's viscously painted floozy, also made in 1900. Can we call it a portrait or even a type? It's caricatural, to use my term, but it's even more of a caricature of a painting than it is of a woman. That coagulated paint, that relish of amateurism, that utter denial of any requirements to be exact, is about finding an equivalent for her coarse sexual presence in the medium, not in description. There are no two ways about it. These paintings do violence with the rules and expectations of painting. The modernist account of painting at this period is too house-trained, habituated to its patterns, neutered by theory. It doesn't take sufficient account of naturalism's dominance. Neither does it acknowledge the sheer creative aggression that was needed to rupture one's reliance on mimesis, to sunder painting from description, to discard illusion for process. In order to understand the heroic modernism of the 1900s, in particular climactic works such as Matisse's Blue Nude and Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon, we must acknowledge the violence of this kind of painting and recognise that what made such aggression necessary was the pact between the naturalist aesthetic and the values of the bourgeois republic. I hope that I have shown you that taking naturalist painting seriously is worth doing. Trying to place it within the history and the mentalité of early Third Republic illuminates the ways in which imagery and ideology could intersect at the end of the 19th century. And one can unearth some good, arresting and even bizarre paintings. The process also makes us look again at avant-garde painting. That, in turn, encourages us to question patterns and assumptions about modernism, which are often taken for granted. I've tried not to discredit the artists who we acknowledge as creative innovators, or to entirely disavow the modernist narrative that makes that case. But I do hope that I've given a richer sense of visual culture in France during the 1880s and 90s, with all its diversity and contradictions. Above all, I hope that the next time you visit the Musée d'Orsay or any other collection of late 19th century French art, you will see the works differently, looking in fresh ways at famous names and giving a chance to the ones that I have tried to judge in the light of history. Thank you.